It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the elements of wrongful death litigation now. Who can sue? How judges are handling these cases amid high-profile lawsuits moving through Wisconsin. In 2021, a jury acquitted Kyle Rittenhouse of all criminal charges for killing two men and injuring another during the 2020 protests in Kenosha. But Rittenhouse still faces legal trouble. He and others are being sued over Rittenhouse's fatal and non-fatal shootings. Call in with your questions about wrongful death lawsuits and how to judge the merits of these cases. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Aiken is a personal injury attorney with the Minneapolis law firm Schwebel, Getz & Sieben. He's licensed to practice in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Aaron, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So this month, a federal judge ruled the wrongful death lawsuit against Kyle Rittenhouse and Kenosha police can proceed. How does this civil litigation differ from criminal prosecution in this case?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. And it's one that's fairly common, I guess, in some civil cases where there's a criminal element. And obviously, in this case, with the criminal cases against Kyle Rittenhouse being adjudicated already, that doesn't preclude the civil lawsuit from being brought. There are different standards of care. There are different elements of the cases. So what happened in the criminal case, really, and the judge said in allowing these cases to proceed, that they could on the merits with new standards and new claims.
Do civil suits have overlapping, like, witnesses or testimony with criminal investigations?
Yeah, of course they do. And frankly, in the majority of my cases where there is a criminal element, a lot of times we're kind of hamstrung by the fact that we don't have access to a lot of the information that we really need to bring these civil cases because the criminal prosecution takes precedence. So in any case, not just this case that we're talking about here, but let's just say in an automobile accident where someone is killed and there's allegations that the defendant really should be charged with something criminally, you know, the state reports, the police reports, the reconstructions, the witness statements, all those things go from the investigating entities into the hands of the prosecutors, who then will determine if charging is appropriate. And if charging is appropriate, that the defendant is charged and then the criminal process plays out. During that, on the civil side, frequently, in fact, most of the time, we just do not have access to most of those documents that we would consider to be critical on the civil side, right? Just from like I say, the reconstruction reports, the witness statements that the police took, and then even access to the criminal defendant. On the civil side, of course, if you start a civil lawsuit right away and you want to depose the defendant with criminal charges hanging out there, they're very commonly just going to plead the fifth and not answer your questions. So just as an overall on the civil side, we most commonly will need the dust to settle on the criminal side before we proceed with civil cases. So the order of things that are happening here in the Rittenhouse case, certainly not unusual at all.
A bit more with timeline here as well, as you say, for the dust to settle for the criminal proceedings. You know, attorneys for the man who was shot and injured by Rittenhouse, they've asked for more time to find and serve Rittenhouse with their lawsuit. How crucial to court proceedings is the delivery of a civil lawsuit to a defendant?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, everybody's got their preconceived notions about what service of process is, right? If a process server shows up at your front door, generally that's not a very good day for you, right? So in this case, and interestingly, on the initial wrongful death claim, they had a lot of trouble with service on Kyle Rittenhouse in that case. In fact, attorneys and process servers in that case submitted affidavits to the court saying that they spent more than 100 hours in multiple states looking for Kyle Rittenhouse. And the official start to any lawsuit, right, is being personally served, right? The defendant being served by one means or another in order to actually kick the lawsuit off. And most of the time in Wisconsin, you're going to need personal service. So interestingly, in that case, in the wrongful death case, they looked from all over the country And what ended up happening, at least according to the court filings and the judge's decision, is that they found his sister in the state of Florida living with his mother. And the process server in that case asked his sister, and it's sort of a process server tactic, I think, when is he going to be home? And she acknowledged that she did not know. And in that case, it was enough to show that he was residing there. And of course, Kyle Rittenhouse's attorneys challenged service in that case. But the judge said, you know, it was obvious that he was evading and that would suffice. So they have to, in Wisconsin, go through this sort of reasonable diligence standard. They can't just stop if they think that there is a way to find him personally before they go to other methods of service. But in this, in the injury case, it seems fairly clear that well, I don't know what the judge is going to do, of course, but it would seem to me that the judge could continue to grant extensions until they find him.
Talking about wrongful death lawsuits with Aaron Aiken, a personal injury attorney, you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Aaron, are there time limits for bringing a wrongful death case?
There are. I mean, in Wisconsin, generally, you're going to have a 3-year statute of limitations on wrongful death cases. That's reduced to 2 years in the case of an automobile accident, right? But yeah, generally, there are going to be those time limits in place to bring a wrongful death case in Wisconsin.
Wrongful death cases, they seek to determine if a loss of life resulted from someone's negligence to use reasonable care. So how is that bar? Like, is negligence a different standard from what must be proven in a criminal case?
Yeah, in the vast majority of the wrongful death cases that I pursue, the first trigger in order for a defendant to actually owe the family money for the loss that they sustained is negligence. And negligence is a really simple standard. It's just it's being reasonable. It's a simple reasonableness standard. So negligence is doing something that a reasonable person would not do, or failing to do something that a reasonable person would do. So let's just say in the case of an automobile accident, right? Somebody blows a red light and kills somebody. You know, you could say that they were negligent in running that red light, right? But that's the trigger in almost any personal injury and wrongful death lawsuit, is just finding negligence. And that's just a simple reasonableness standard. And in the civil cases, they need to find that by a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, versus in a criminal case, everybody knows the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, right? Where you need to prove that before taking somebody's liberty away and putting them in jail. Civil side, the burden to prove these elements of any case is a lot less.
But how do you know the difference between an act of negligence versus civil rights violations, when someone's civil rights have been violated?
Boy, so these the Rittenhouse cases, they're brought under the 1983, the civil rights claim, saying basically that his due process, he was deprived of his due process rights, right? And a jury is going to have to look at that and conclude it. And the judge in allowing these cases to proceed didn't weigh in on whether or not they can do that. That should be pretty clear on. Even in the claims of negligence against Mr. Rittenhouse, the judge said, you know, basically, I'm not sure how they would proceed, because it would appear that this was intentional. But at the same time, I'm going to allow it to proceed because a jury could conclude that. So in these initial motions that were brought, you know, that the standard that the judge used was much, much different.
Hmm. We learn about wrongful death litigation here in Wisconsin with attorney Aaron Aiken, taking us deeper into the damages, who's entitled to file this type of suit, what negligence means. Call in with your questions, your comments about wrongful death cases, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how wrongful death litigation works in Wisconsin, considering lawsuits against Kyle Rittenhouse, City of Kenosha officials, and others stemming from the 2020 Kenosha protests in the aftermath of the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Call in with your questions, your comments about civil trials for wrongful death and how they work, 800-642-1234. We have personal injury attorney Aaron Aiken, who stays with us. Let's go to Julie in Madison. Julie, what would you like to share?
I have a question. I'm retired law enforcement, and I'm wondering if there's a comparison here that would be helpful in the long run to improve the situation. What I'm hearing on your show is that people might do something wrong and then find that they could hide and successfully avoid. In sensitive crimes in the past that I worked in, children who were abused, were the statute of limitations was so short that they couldn't even report after they were adults. And then that statute of limitations changed and extended. I'm wondering if you think that changing laws such that, or proposing legislation that doesn't allow for as long a limitation, or I should say a longer time for people to sue would be helpful to avoid the problem of people doing something wrong and then hiding wherever they can in the country and the statute of limitations running out.
Julie, thank you. Aaron.
Yeah, Julie, thanks for calling in. And that is a good question. And I'm going to address it in terms of civil cases that the victims of sex abuse could pursue. Right. There are statute of limitations, and they're especially difficult, including children who sometimes won't come forward with what happened until later in life. In fact, many jurisdictions across the country, including here in Minnesota, I believe it was in 2016, reopened the statute of limitations for 3 years to make it basically unlimited for people to come forward from 2016 to 2019 with accusations against their abusers. So yeah, it is really unfortunate, especially in that case. And Julie, that's a good question, because you bring up one of the most difficult statute of limitations questions, and certainly something that legislatively would need to be addressed, right? Because that's the statute of limitations is set by the legislatures in Wisconsin and Minnesota. In fact, I think that there was some discussion about this a few years ago in Wisconsin. I'm not sure what happened to it, to be frank, but you are correct. That statute of limitations, that's an ultimate bar to those claims, and one that really, really is tragic for the victims.
When Minnesota opened it up, what did you experience?
Yeah, there was a huge uptick in those claims. And I personally handled several of them. So people were able to come forward. In the case I was handling, we uncovered, you know, unfortunately, many other victims of the same abuser. And, you know, it was an opportunity for those people to come forward and say what had happened to them. And then interestingly, when they get brought up that far later in life, you know, 30 years down the line, you can really, instead of looking forward and projecting what's going to happen to the person, you can look back and see the impact that it's had on their lives.
Let's look at caps on damages. State law,
sure,
here in Wisconsin for financial damages, you know, being awarded in wrongful death cases. What is the policy reasoning for having caps on damages?
Boy, as far as policy, I'm not positive, but I do know in Wisconsin, you know, you have non-economic caps on wrongful death. Okay. So the state of Wisconsin has said for non-economic losses, that's comfort, aid, companionship, support for your husband, your child, whoever it is that had been killed, that's capped at an adult. If you're 18 or older, that's capped at $350,000 in non-economic losses. For a child, the state of Wisconsin says that's $500,000. Comparing that to Minnesota, where we do not have those caps right now. Bear in mind, those are just non-economic losses, aid, comfort, companionship, support. That doesn't include economic losses, right? So let's say a 40-year-old father was making $100,000 a year, was killed, and his wife brings a wrongful death lawsuit on his behalf. She could still collect that and my math is not great, especially on the radio, but I think I can do 25 times 100 so that they can collect that 2.5 million in economic losses. Mm. But then the non-economic caps, you see in cases I've handled at Wisconsin, they're just, boom, that's what it's worth, $350,000, right?
So how do you calculate the person who's killed, their life expectancy and the economic losses caused by the wrongful death?
Boy, yeah. So some of it is simple math, like the one I just said to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But other times it's more complicated. The both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they'll tell you how long you're supposed to live in our jury guidelines. So the judge will say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, he was 40. He has a life expectancy of 33 years. On top of that, that's the expectation. They can deviate upwards and downwards if they had different health issues, whatnot. For bringing in economic losses, we always will bring in vocational experts or economic experts, because most of the time, you have to factor in their consumption. You have to factor in their career, inflation, all sorts of things that aren't as easy as the 25 times 100,000, which, Kate, I really hope I got right.
But does the lack of limits on damage payouts result, do you think, in more wrongful death cases in Minnesota?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I've never consulted with a potential wrongful death client in Wisconsin and had them say, oh, geez, I'm not going to pursue it because there's this $350,000 or $500,000 cap. And that's just my view. But I've never had someone say, no, I'm not going to do this because of that.
We're talking about wrongful death lawsuits with Aaron Aiken, a personal injury attorney. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Dwayne and Weston called regarding the jury size of criminal cases that involve civil wrongful deaths. And Dwayne is wondering, does a jury have to be anonymous?
Does a jury have to be anonymous? I think in some cases, and I should say, I'm not positive on that answer, but in some cases, especially in high profile cases, the judges are going to do their best to sequester the jurors and make sure that people don't find out about who they are. In fact, I think there was during the Rittenhouse criminal case, I think that there was an issue about some members of the press following the jury, and the judge, I think if you really don't want to make a judge mad like that when they're doing their best to protect people who, nobody has ever called me with a jury summons and said, hey, Aaron, I am so excited about going to jury duty next week. What do I need to do to make sure I get on the panel? No. So the jury really, in my view, ultimately needs to be respected. Their privacy needs to be respected. These are our neighbors, our friends, our relatives that are taking time, real time out of their, everybody's got a busy day to go in and do their job. So in my view, the judges and everybody involved should do our level best to protect their privacy.
You mentioned high profile litigation, and I want to land on Alec Baldwin and Rust, the receiving civil lawsuits here, charged, with involuntary manslaughter over the death of the cinematographer for the film Rust. And so in October, the production company announced Baldwin settled a civil suit brought by the family of Helena Hutchins. And then this month, we're seeing the cinematographer's sister and parents file a separate suit. Is that, different family members bringing different lawsuits, is that common?
And I should say, I think that happened in New Mexico. So I'm not sure when it comes in New Mexico. In Minnesota, we have one person, the trustee for the next of kin, who's appointed by the court, who has sole authority to bring the case, right? In Wisconsin, it can be a variety of different family members based on their relationship. It's laid out in statute to spouses, kids, parents, that sort of thing. And they could ultimately bring their own cases in Wisconsin. They would be consolidated by any motion of the court, because obviously it's hard to address the full exposure if you're only doing one at a time. I should say I don't know anything, frankly, about New Mexico law. there are a variety of different reasons that people would settle a civil case, though I should say that, not just specifically in this case. And any settlement I've ever been involved in with respect to how it would impact the criminal case, I have, I guess I shouldn't say never, but hardly ever seen a civil settlement where there's an admission of wrongdoing, right? So it wouldn't be like you'd say, hey, we're going to settle this case, but then I'm admitting that these criminal elements, nobody would ever, I can't imagine, at least anyone with counsel would do that.
Aaron, thank you for joining us.
No problem, Kate. It was a pleasure being here.
Aaron Aiken is a personal injury attorney with the Minneapolis law firm Schwebel, Getz & Sieben. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A central Wisconsin food pantry has grown into a hub for social services and community. The Abbotsford Area Collaborative Team distributes food. It also connects hundreds of families to health care and other services. And its leader says they're meeting more families every week who need help. Rob Menser reports.
It's about 10 degrees in Abbotsford. Outside St. Bernard's Catholic Church, the Reverend Tim Odenhoven is talking with a man who's waiting in line for the food pantry. The man doesn't have a winter coat.
You enter like this in a basement, you take a much
Odenhoven tells the man he's welcome to go down to the church basement and pick out one of the coats there from the donations pile.
You have a look in this seat, okay? Todos para ustedes.
Take what you need, okay? They're all for you. Odenhoven is the priest at St. Bernard's. For the last 3 years, he's also led the church's food pantry. Every Thursday, they distribute food to about 230 families in the rural central Wisconsin region. Odenhoven says the food pantry was initially a pandemic response.
We grew very quickly from the onset. I mean, it started maybe with 30, 40 families, with the federal aid boxes, the farm-to-family boxes, and then it just mushroomed to where we're serving 100, 150 families and 200 families. And the 230 we're at right now, it's going to go up from there.
Unemployment rates in Wisconsin have been at record lows. But Suzanne Becker says food pantries across the state have seen demand increase. She leads the Eau Claire-based Feed My People food bank and says many clients are people who have jobs.
Maybe they're the two parents who are working and they're paying their bills, but there's nothing left over at the end of the day.
The United Way has focused on the challenges of these families. They have incomes above the federal poverty line, but below the expenses of rent, food, and childcare. When the price of groceries or gas goes up, they feel the pinch.
There's no wiggle room, right? That's what we have seen. We've seen all kinds of families finding themselves in need for the first time.
Now, food pantries across the state are bracing for a new increase in demand. That's because in March, about 400,000 Wisconsin families will see a reduction in their food share benefits. During the pandemic, families received at least $95 per month in additional benefits from the federal government. In December, Congress voted to bring those additional benefits to an end. In Abbotsford, some families have another challenge. About half the population here are Latino immigrants, and many don't have legal status. Odenhoven is not Hispanic, but he's worked to build trust in the Latino community. He preaches two Spanish-language masses each week. He says he speaks more Spanish than English every day. And that wasn't the case when he came to Abbotsford 12 years ago.
It was very hard. I started speaking pretty much no Spanish, and back then, most of them didn't speak any English. Of course, that's changed over 12 years now, as the people have been here longer. So we were all kind of new together. A lot of people had just arrived at that point, so it really was we're all in this together.
The food pantry has also partnered with H2N, a WASA-based organization that promotes health equity. Isis Vidal with H2N has been coming to Abbotsford each week for more than 2 years. She and others help clients take care of health care or transportation needs. Vidal immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico more than two decades ago.
Now I know how those people feel, you know, like when they don't know, when they are new in town and they don't know who can help them.
So this is my primary staff
On a tour of the church, Odenhoven opens a confessional door.
This used to be a confessional. It's no longer.
It's filled nearly to the ceiling with boxes of rice, dried beans, cereal. He says operating the food pantry has been eye-opening.
I do believe that there was a need that we just didn't notice before. And it was that unheard need. And that's a problem.
Odenhoven is making plans to expand the kind of support residents can get through the church. This spring, the Family Health Center of Marshfield will be opening a permanent health clinic in the church's basement. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to algae blooms that we usually hear about in the dog days of summer when warm water allows algae to grow thicker and faster. Scientists have new evidence that these blooms form in cold and even ice-covered waters. Call in with your questions or thoughts about blue-green algae and its impact on our watersheds, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kate Reinel is a limnologist and research coordinator for the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. Kate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Environmental Protection Agency says algae thrive in warm temperatures, and scientists have known that for a long time. What is going on in cold water?
Yeah, so it is really well documented that cyanobacterial blooms, also known as blue-green algae or harmful algal blooms, grow in warm temperatures or when there's high nutrients. But there's also this other category of blooms where they're appearing in colder conditions. And so we know that temperature is not the only thing that contributes to the formation of algal blooms, and that there are other factors such as nutrients, adaptations of the organisms themselves that can allow them to thrive in conditions such as cold temperatures.
Take us through your research and how you have been studying this, how you discovered this aspect in Lake Superior.
So this is actually something that I didn't discover in Lake Superior, but it was born out of my research that began in Lake Superior. So when I was back doing my PhD at the Large Lakes Observatory, part of University of Minnesota Duluth, and of course Duluth, Minnesota, I started working on cyanobacterial blooms in Lake Superior when we really were just first becoming aware of them. And through that, I've really kind of started to be really interested in and investigate these situations where blooms are really surprising. So we were all really surprised when we started seeing blooms in Lake Superior because it's typically a lot colder than other lakes, and it's much lower nutrients in particular. And so I've really kind of been interested in these surprising occasions where we see algal blooms. And so through that, I came into this topic of blooms that are occurring in cold water temperature conditions, which was part of a collaborative effort that we conceived at the Global Lakes Ecological Observatory Network meeting, myself and several other colleagues. And that's really where this project began.
Your research team found nearly 20 blooms in ice-covered conditions. How common are algae blooms in icy waters?
So that's a great question. We really don't know. So a lot of what this work is trying to do that we recently published is just call attention to this. So, you know, the current paradigm is that these blooms are really just appearing when temperatures are very warm and nutrients are very high, and we know that that's not always the case. And so, you know, we've been seeing evidence, which we provide in the published paper, that shows that these blooms do indeed occur when there are cold water temperatures, which we define as less than 15 degrees Celsius, which is around 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and including, as you said, ice-covered conditions. But we don't really have a full catalog of how often this really occurs for many reasons, including, you know, one, we just don't really expect it in winter, so we're not really looking for it. A lot of monitoring programs are focused on summer, you know, and those sorts of things. So it's kind of a call to action of, hey, we need to better understand this.
Are the blooms that you're documenting and monitoring in the colder water just as toxic and harmful as what appear in summer months?
So we didn't investigate toxins, and a lot of this documentation that we collected, is some of it was from peer review journals, but some of it was anecdotal or from newspaper, reports and things like that, or just personal observations. And so that was not an aspect that we studied. So that's something that certainly needs to be better understood in investigating how cold water blooms form and, their characteristics, including toxin production.
I would also wonder, and it probably falls in that same category, are there certain types of algae that tolerate cold water more and do well in it? Or are they evolving, things like that?
Right. So there are actually certain types of algae that do typically do better in cold water temperatures, but cyanobacteria are typically associated with warmer temperatures. But what we document in our research is that there's actually a wide tolerance for some species. So there's kind of like genetic strain differences. So you might find one strain has optimal temperatures that are around 18 or 20 degrees Celsius, whereas others might be as low as 15 or even and lower for optimal temperatures. The other caveat to that is that just because temperatures or conditions aren't optimal doesn't mean that growth can't happen. Oh, I have a helper today.
That's okay. Carry on. We love helpers.
Yeah. Hi, buddy. We can still have significant growth at lower temperatures.
Limnologist Kate Reinel with us, researcher with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve, studying harmful algae blooms, new evidence showing they can occur in cold water, even under ice. Call in with your questions about this, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we examine scientific research on algae blooms. Clear water turning into thick green scum. New evidence suggesting it's a threat in cold water and ice-covered water. Call in about blooms on your lake. What you wonder about algae that suck up all the oxygen, 800-642-1234. We have limnologist Kate Reinel, research coordinator at Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve, part of a network of 30 reserves nationwide designated for this type of research on coastal resources and our human impacts. Kate, what are the next steps in your research of nuisance algae?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects that I'm interested in. I'm located right on Lake Superior. So continuing to understand drivers of cyanobacterial blooms in Lake Superior is really kind of top of my list, as well as within the St. Louis River estuary, which is also listed as an area of concern. And so understanding what drives blooms in my area in particular is really kind of top of the list, but I'm still interested in continuing doing work and understanding these blooms that occur in conditions that are really surprising, such as cold water conditions and low nutrient conditions as well.
Is there anything that can or should be done to treat or to contain algae blooms in winter icy waters?
That's a really great question. And unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that, because we really don't understand at this point what are the drivers of cold water blooms. So in our paper, we hypothesize some different processes or mechanisms that could be contributing to these blooms, but we really just don't know a lot about them, and we really don't have a lot of awareness about them to begin with. So the first step is, really making a targeted effort to document how common they are and understand the processes behind them before we can really do much work into understanding how we could control them in cold temperatures.
How would you go about coordinating that? How would you document and monitor this in the winter months and make sure that, scientists are able to do all of this in a coordinated fashion?
So that's always a challenge, no matter what the season is. But, a first start is that a lot of our monitoring programs really just cover the summer months, and for a lot of good reasons. One, it's a lot easier to sample in the summer. And also that's, you know, typically where people are spending a lot more time interacting with the water. So expanding our monitoring season to be year round is a first start, including looking at samples that are collected from under ice conditions. And doing this in a coordinated way really kind of depends on the lake or the network that you're working in. So for Lake Superior and the St. Louis River Estuary, for example, we have many different institutions and agencies that are working together. And so you really kind of have to tailor it to the group that's working in that particular system.
Let's bring on a call now. Ryan is with us in Fitchburg. Hi, Ryan. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, how are you? And I really appreciate the discussion. I think that water estuaries as well as harmful algae in Wisconsin is going to be a big deal as we kind of progress in the next 10 years. But, you know, I do have a question for you. I know that we actually, as a company at BioIonics, were approved for red tide destruction in seawater applications. One of actually the only two solutions approved by the Chilean government. We've been working in the salmon industry for about close to 5 or 6 years now. Has your team looked at any type of electrochemical or electrolysis solution for destroying harmful algae?
No, we haven't looked into those types of solutions. In the area, the region that I'm working in the St. Louis River Estuary and Lake Superior, our awareness of cyanobacterial blooms, whether they're new or not, but, you know, our research on them is really still in its infancy. And so we still need to understand what exactly is causing them. Even just tracking them is a really big challenge because, you know, in this system, they can be really ephemeral, where you have a beach or, a pocket of water that's really, really green. And then within a day, the wind has changed and it has dispersed. And so we have to do a lot of foundational research before we can jump in with hands-on management and solutions.
How do the really wide winter temperature swings affect algae growth?
That's an open question. So, we don't understand a lot about what is driving these blooms. We hypothesize a couple of different ways that they could form. So one is that they're initiated and grow in cold water temperatures. So likely what would drive that is adaptations of the cyanobacteria itself. So being able to withstand cold temperatures or potentially low light and nutrient conditions. Blooms that are subsurface. So, just because a bloom is not on the surface of a body of water doesn't mean that there isn't actually a bloom there. It's documented in many different water bodies. So those blooms can form in cold temperatures well below the surface of the lake. And then, you know, during a mixing event or an upwelling event, it can be brought to the surface where we do observe it. And then there are also, of course, blooms that are formed during the summer that continue into the fall and winter. And so it's really not clear at this point how fluctuating winter temperatures will affect cold water blooms at this time. But we do speculate a little bit how rising temperatures with climate change could affect these types of blooms in the future, particularly through changes in ice cover.
When you look at the Great Lakes more broadly, how does the risk of blooms in Lake Superior compare to other Great Lakes?
Oh, that's such a hard question to answer, excuse me. I think that when we look at, you know, Lake Erie, for example, it's a severe problem. You know, it's massive compared to what we're looking at Lake Superior. And so, you know, trying to put Lake Superior in the context of the other Great Lakes, I think isn't necessarily something that we want to do, because while blooms in Lake Superior are not as severe relative to the other Great Lakes, we don't want to let it get to that point. And so we need to be really proactive about the way that we're approaching these blooms, understanding what is driving them and doing what we can to mitigate and prevent them in the future.
Talking with Kate Reinel, limnologist with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kate, we heard from Irene, called from Middleton, and was wondering if there's been research done to put algae blooms to good use. Irene mentioned that there's been research done to make fuel from these blooms. Is there anything that you can see where you could use this algae for good use?
Yeah, that's great. It's not something that I focus on specifically in my research or something that we've explored in Lake Superior, because you would have to harvest, I think, quite a bit. But yes, I am aware that you can use algal blooms for good use, or repurpose them essentially into things such as biofuels.
How is Lake Superior, in its vastness and its cold water, how is it susceptible to the impacts of the climate crisis?
Oh, well, that's a really big question. So focusing in, though, on cyanobacterial blooms, you know, it seems like in Lake Superior, what evidence we have so far is that rising temperatures and warm temperatures do play an important role in Lake Superior. So the research that I did with my group of colleagues for this Blooms Also Like It Cold paper, that's a bit of a different thing than what we see in Lake Superior. So in Lake Superior, while temperatures are not very, very high, they are rising. It's one of the most rapidly warming lakes in the world by summer surface temperature. And so it does seem that in Lake Superior, warming temperatures, as well as, you know, these years where we have big storms, seem to be contributing to the appearance of blooms in this lake.
What could you learn from your national network in protecting Lake Superior? I mean, you're part of this 30 coastal sites around the U.S., and I would imagine problem solving together on these estuarine systems. What could you learn from your colleagues?
That's a really great question. And I think, you know, we're really kind of in the early stages of this, but you know, what we can learn from the network is what are the similarities and drivers in different estuarine systems, and try to take lessons learned from other systems and apply them here. So while we are all part of this National Estuarine Research Reserve system, each estuary is unique in a lot of ways. And while we are part of this larger system, many of the estuaries that are part of the reserve system are located on the saltwater coast. And so the only other fully freshwater estuary is at Old Woman Creek in Lake Erie. And so in some cases, you can certainly have lessons learned and find commonalities, but in a lot of ways, these systems are really different.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this research.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Kate Reinel is a limnologist and a research coordinator for the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. We have a link to the journal article. It's titled Blooms Also Like It Cold. It appears in Limnology and Oceanography Letters. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.